This is called For the Love of the Game. Give me a man with a quick first step, with court vision that takes in all of me. A man who can play in the paint, score from all over, finding my perimeter, a man who can drive my lane. Give me a man who makes his free throws ready to shoot two whenever I demand. My interior defense isn't tough to crack. I'm wide open and I can handle the ball. I don't care for monster dunks, for slam jam, thank you, ma'am. I'd rather have a man who can teach me the delicate technique of the finger roll. A man who doesn't bang the boards, but who knows how to rebound, how to come from behind. An assist leader, a shooter, a penetrator, a man who knows how to stay out of foul trouble, hands off the opposing team's cheerleaders. I want this madness to last much longer than March, to stage endless tournaments on a court not polished but rumpled, a sweaty sight where the pairings are known, the brackets full, championships staged, whenever we feel the need for a fast break, bodies colliding under the basket. The lives of girls and women, it's a constant theme throughout my work, and this is my clumsy, heavy-handed attempt to do for young women what Gwendolyn Brooks does in her poem, Seven at the Golden Shovel, We Real Cool. If you listen, you might hear a little echo of that poem, but since I'm a far less worthy poet, mine is a lot longer. This is called Adolescence. No one calls you beautiful at 14, or knows the longings that fill your body, except the other girls who lurk late with you. The awkward emerging women you are becoming, fragile as the puff you powder yourselves with, the mirrored compact. Too early for any man, though you're learning the trappings, leather heels, lipstick, tight hose dark around legs that tremble beneath cold street lights. Too early for breath, for the full flesh that marks your passage from one another into the arms of lovers. In clear night air, all you have is the silence of waiting together, of learning the rules of attraction, the walk, the talk, the hair, the perfume you spray on each wrist, behind each ear, along the vulnerable throat. I'm going to read some poems from Imitation of Life. My poems come from the merging of memory and narrative. Years later, they come back and they visit and they say, hey, now's the time. And this next poem comes from a couple of things colliding. There's a picture of me in my family's album, and since I'm the last remaining member, other than my sister, I have all these artifacts and pieces of things, but in our family album of me, as a young child, sitting on the lap of a African-American Santa, which didn't seem odd to me. But then later on, many years later, when I was a graduate student in Indiana, there was a mall somewhere in the Indianapolis area that had hired for that Christmas season a black Santa. And the mall patrons were outraged. And years later, those two things collided and this poem resulted. The Black Santa. I remember sitting on his bony lap, fake beard slumping off his face, his breath reeking sweetly of alcohol, a scent I didn't yet know at 5. And I didn't know that Santa was supposed to be fat, white, merry, not shaky and thin like this department store Santa who listened as I reeled off that year's list. A child's oven I'd burned my fingers on, a mini record player of gaudy plastic I'd drag from room to room by its precarious orange handle, an etch-a-sketch I'd ruin by twisting its dials too hard, my requests as solemn as prayer, fervid, fueled by too many hours of television, too many commercials filled with noisy children elated by the latest game or toy. I bet none of them ever sat on the lap of a Santa who didn't ho, ho, ho in jolly mirth, whose sunken red eyes peered out from under his oversized wig and red velveteen cap, his teeth yellow, long fingers tinged with yellow. I did not find it strange to call this man Santa, to whisper my childish whispers into his ear, to pull on his sleeve, to let him know I really deserved all that I'd asked for. I posed for an instant photo with him, a woolen cap over my crooked braids, mittens sewn to my coat sleeves. No one could have convinced me this Santa couldn't slide down any chimney, though his belly didn't fill his suit, and his hands trembled just a bit as he lifted me from his lap. No one could have told me that a pink-cheeked, pale-skinned Santa was the only Santa to worship, to beg for toys and candy. I wouldn't have believed them. Wouldn't have believed anyone who'd tell me Santa couldn't look like me. Brown eyes, face, skin. This next poem is about my parents, who were immigrants from the Caribbean. And lots of times I didn't understand what they were saying, which I figured out later wasn't necessarily a condition of them being Caribbean people. It's just you're someone's child, and often you don't understand what your parents are saying. For me, it was just the culturally flavored by the fact that they were from the Caribbean, but my father in particular, often I had to translate or figure out what it was he was asking me to do. So he dominates this poem. It's called Translating My Parents. When my father would growl, "Wash the wares now," I always thought he'd said WEDS. Learned to move to the sink quickly in terror. Knew his order meant wash the dishes right away and don't use too much soap. And when mother asked me to put serviettes on the table, I knew she meant set the table, use napkins, the paper kind. What sort of English was this that they spoke so surely? An odd lingo of strange terms like brawly and dustbin for umbrella and trash can. Flannel instead of washcloth. Plimsolls instead of sneakers. Baffled by their love of fish and chips, crisps and crumpets, I wondered why they drank tea instead of coffee, why my father downed Guinness instead of Miller High Life, making me sip that dark, bitter stout, laughing as I grimaced, wrinkling my 8-year-old nose. I couldn't imagine them living in any other country but this one, in any other house but this one. Couldn't imagine the house of my birth. 289 Whiteman Road, London Borough of Haringey. The only borough I knew was the Bronx. And there, an elevator was an elevator, not a lift. A cookie was a cookie, not a biscuit. And no one dared call sausage and potatoes bangers and mash. I learned to translate their dialect into an English I could recognize. So when my father nagged, write a Z and write it properly, I knew he truly meant write a Z, as in zipper, as in zero, and write it plainly so I can read it. For a long time, I had no way to define where I was from in New York because a lot of people hadn't heard or had no association with the Bronx other than perhaps the New York Yankees. But now, especially, I can tell people that I am from the same area of the Bronx as J-Lo. Yes, she's Jenny from the block. I'm Allie from the block. I can keep the same husband. But this next poem is a Bronx poem. Supermercado, which translates to supermarket. The TV ads thunder, "Tops in El Bronx." So my father and I make a pact, set out in pursuit of fruit to a warehouse turned supermarket with sawdust on the floors and crates cracked open in the aisles. More abundance here than in scanty neighborhood stores. So much to pick through, mull over. Peaches so ripe in their blushing, fuzzy skins, we are tempted to munch them right there. Juice seeping down our chins like water seeping into earth. Here we are brown people unashamed to love watermelon. Stereotypes giving way when we see that red-pink flesh that we know is juicier than any kiss, welcoming even the unobtrusive seeds that will slip subtly from our mouths. My father hands me 3 plastic bags, pushes me towards mounds of lemons, limes, tangerines, chiding me to find the best ones, unblemished, almost ready, globes of yellow and orange, each one a world I admire, feeling its nubby skin just moments before I tuck it in the right bag. Why have mere grapes when mangoes beckon, when we can taste the extravagance beneath their green going yellow going red skins, when we can imagine mango pulp sweet and tart and light on our tongues? Apples are too ordinary for us. When here we can buy huge coconuts we'll later crack open, sip cool sugary water from, when we can indulge in pineapple, kiwi, pomegranate, fruit congregating in our basket, then in our car, in all the not-so-sleek cars of our city, carrying away this fruit, plump flesh enfolding pits, tang singing beneath rinds. I wrote this poem, the next poem, probably about 5 years before the current Michael Jackson problems. So there are no references in this particular poem to children. But one of the issues surrounding Michael that gets joked about a lot but never seriously discussed is what's happened to his skin and his hair. And I think there was a real grieving as I saw how, well, he doesn't look like a white person, he doesn't look like a person anymore. But there's something that I want to remember. So I wrote this poem to commemorate what I wanted to remember. Shake Your Body, for Michael Jackson. This is the Michael I want to remember. Full lips, afro large as life, lithe body, slim but not dangerous, mouth imploring us to dance, shout, shake our bodies down to the ground. His face his own, untouched by surgery. This Michael's no freak show, his dancing not reduced to crotch grabs and pyrotechnics, skin not powdered beyond recognition to a zone neither black nor white, but phantom-like, pallid as talk. This Michael still glittered, still shone, his nose broad across his face, hair untouched by chemicals that would slick his afro to a dead sheen, greasy under stage lights. This Michael was on his way to being a man, a black man, someone whose albums I wouldn't hide, whose voice wouldn't turn into mere vocal ticks, tricks, a parody of itself, a joke we're all aware of except for Michael himself, who's left behind our ghettos, streets, left behind Detroit and Newark, Little Rock and Gary. The Michael I want to remember blamed it on the boogie. It, the energy, no one can deny him. Boogie, that irresistible urge to dance. The dance uncomplicated by the dancer, uncompromised as the face he used to possess. Broad, brown, African. This next poem is born out of a writing exercise I like to give myself. I like to write a lot about music. and I was envisioning what for me would be the world's worst jukebox. And you can translate this very easily into just about anything, you know, your own personal list. I wrote another poem called The World's Worst White Supremacist, which I'm glad I never published, because it's about this Matt Hale dude who has stepped back into the news recently because of what's happened to the judge's family. But unfortunately, he's a graduate of the law school of my current university. You know, we used to have our visiting writers readings over at the law school because they had a nice auditorium, and we, you know, show people, oh, here's this person, here's our white supremacist graduate. And it was funny at the time, but now it's absolutely horrific. And the thing about him is, the reason I tabbed him for this poem is, as a white supremacist, he's awful. He's a pencil-necked geek, you know? He if you ever see this guy, you know, he's the kind of guy that you would fire. He got through our law school somehow and then promptly started suing everybody. He sued the Peoria Symphony because, I don't know why, I guess they just wanted to get rid of a violin-playing white supremacist. So I wrote a poem about him, so that he was the world's worst white supremacist in my view. But this is a much more lighthearted poem called The World's Worst Jukebox. And it's one of those poems where the title sort of spills into the first line. The world's worst jukebox plays every song you've ever hated, maudlin country ballads and stupid novelty hits, syrupy pop ditties from the 70s, tunes so chipper and insistent you still know the words after 20 years, can remember how these songs sounded coming out of your handheld radio, hiss slithering from the cheap transistor, static marking spaces between stations. It's hard to fathom why someone would put tunes this bad together. Deliberate cruelty, you think, as you lean over the shimmering machine in search of one good song for your shiny quarter. You can't deal with hearing that Captain and Tennille gush that love will keep them together, but your other choices are no better. The Swedish smaltz of ABBA's Dancing Queen, the disco version of the theme to Star Wars, Chuck Berry's number one embarrassment, my ding-a-ling. There's no Beatles or Stones on this Wurlitzer, just bland British invasion wimps Chad and Jeremy, the simpering corn of David Gates and Brad. No Sly Stone or Prince in the Revolution either, but Kung Fu Fighting instead, a song whose phony martial arts shouts thrilled us all when we were eight. Groups no one's heard of since their one chart hit live on in infamy here, the breathy vocals of Andrea True, former porn star, the disembodied female chants of Silver Convention, another Euro disco product of interchangeable singers. There are two different versions of Muskrat Love, every smarmy hit by Air Supply, and singles from bands whose very names are bad omens, Vanilla Fudge, Pink Lady, the Chipmunks. You want to grab someone, anyone. You want to collar the band's manager for an explanation, demanding the name of the person who did this, threatening to storm his house, to ask how anyone could give us a jukebox with no Supremes or Vandellas, but with the Crystals singing, "He hit me and it felt like a kiss." A dirge with lyrics so vile, few stations ever played it, a song no one will punch, not even on this jukebox. That song title is a real song title. Phil Spector forced Ronnie to record it with her group, and because he told her, you know, I found you little black girls on the streets, and I can find another bunch of black girls very easily, so you're going to record this song. And interestingly enough, the person who's done a cover version of it recently is Courtney Love. I am always being told that I don't speak like a black person for whatever reasons. And I wanted to analyze that in the poem. Like, what do you mean that I don't speak like a black person. Does that mean I don't offend you, or I do offend you, or what does that mean? And I remembered my mother growing up in the islands. In school, she would get struck on the palm of her hand for not speaking properly. You know, they'd hit her on the palm of the hand. So the first line of this poem comes from the memory, her memory of being actually hit because she didn't speak the right way. On being told that I don't speak like a black person, emphasize the hitch, your ignorant hoss, was what my mother was told when colonial-minded teachers slapped her open palm with a ruler in that Jamaican schoolroom. Trained in England, they tried to force their pupils to speak like Eliza Doolittle after her transformation, fancying themselves British as Henry Higgins, despite dark, sun-ripened skin. Mother never lost her accent, though. The music of her voice charming everyone, an infectious lilt I can imitate, not duplicate. No one in the States told her to eliminate the accent. My high school friends adoring the way her voice would lift when she called me to the phone, Allison, it's friend Kathy. Why don't you sound like her, they'd ask. I didn't sound like anyone or anything. No grating New Yorker nasality, no fastidious British mannerisms like the ones my father affected when he wanted to sell someone something. And I didn't sound like a black American, college acquaintances observed. Sure, they knew what a black person was supposed to sound like. Was I supposed to sound lazy? Dropping syllables here and there, not finishing words, but slurring their final letters so that each sentence joined the next, sliding past the listener. Were certain words off limits, too erudite for someone whose skin came with a natural tan? I asked them what they meant, and they stuttered, blushed, said, you know, black English, applying a term from that semester's text. Does everyone in your family speak alike? I'd ask. And they'd say, don't take this the wrong way, nothing personal. Now I realize there's nothing more personal than speech, that I don't have to defend how I speak, how any person, black, white, chooses to speak. Let us speak, let us talk with the sound of our mothers and our fathers still reverberating in our minds, wherever our mothers or fathers come from, Arkansas, Belize, Alabama, Brazil, Aruba, Arizona. Let us simply speak to one another, listen and prize the inflections, never assuming how any person will sound until his mouth opens, until her mouth opens. Greetings, welcome in any language. A friend of mine who teaches where I used to teach in Little Rock used this book in one of his courses. So my husband's originally from Little Rock, and we went back, and I went in the used bookstore, and I find a copy of my book. I'm like, oh, shh. And I turn to see if there are any margin markings, and it seemed like this poem really offended this person because they wrote, preaching! I'm like, okay. All right. I'm going to read just a few more poems. This particular book is my new book. And a lot of the poems here harken back to my interest in girls and women and how we get from one to the other. And there's a series of portraits, character studies in the back of this book, and I'll just read one of those. It's about that period, junior high through high school, where you walk around with a label on your back. Well, you have a name, but you're usually either, you know, the smart girl or the shy girl or the jealous girl or the dirty girl or the slutty girl or whatever you are. This is the dangerous girl. The dangerous girl makes every teacher angry, brings things to school she knows they'll confiscate, cigarette lighters engraved with her father's initials,
condoms stolen from her mother's dresser, limp Trojans she found beneath hankies and tangled bras, dirty pictures torn from her brother's magazines, pets and playmates preening in soft focus, their breasts unlike any we'd seen. The dangerous girl sits in back during every class, parroting her teacher's words in a malicious hiss, carving curses on her desk with a shiny knife blade. How she fascinates me, this girl who bullies anyone, who gets in her way, who talks back fearlessly to adults, getting away with it because she's so pretty, so slight. No one holds her accountable. Oh, to have her power, to walk out on class whenever, to wear clothes as loose or as tight as she likes, to shoplift gold bracelets in one swift motion, not getting caught. I want to be her friend, to call her at home for desperate conversations about which boys kiss deepest, their hands plunging lower. She doesn't need me, though, returns my notes unread, sneering at my plaid skirts, knee socks. But one day she'll get caught at something so devious, not even I could save her, lifting the principal's wallet, setting fires in the girls' bathroom. She'll look at me then as they lead her to the exit, and beneath her scorn, she'll wish she had been my friend. At least then there'd be someone else to blame, some fool to take the rap. I'm gonna end with two poems. This next poem, I think every poet ends up writing one of these poems. It's sort of your life credo poem, and you're always told, don't write that poem where you say what poetry is supposed to be. Please don't write that poem. But I guess five books in, I thought I could get away with it. And I think part of this poem came out of the fact that for years I've been an editor as well as a writer, and reading so many sad-ass poems. And I mean both halves of that construction, just so many poems mired in their own sort of smug sadness. And we all write those poems, and then we send them out and hope that someone on the other end will love them. And I love some of them, but I don't love all of them. So this poem came to me, and I hope you take it in the spirit that it's intended. Against pathos, write me no more poems of yearning, no more desires spun thin and secondhand, no more books sedate as loneliness, their blue hues and cries imprecise as some sailor's back alley songs, refrain after refrain, intermittent melody. Bring me no more elegies, no more testimonials or faded photographs of long dead, wan-faced girls reticent through exotic illnesses, fainting spells. Give me no pastels, no faint of heart colors meant to lull us asleep in waiting rooms, doctor's offices. Give me music, brassy, ugly, and strong, garish carousel tunes at top speed, soundtracks to MGM movie musicals played by full orchestras. Show me your ruddy spirit, your skin livid with wrinkles, your heart pumping in its glistening cavern, unashamed to be muscle, to move without longing or desire, not compromising in its clench and unclench, a fist unfurling. And I'm going to end with a spring poem, because I know it's not spring yet, but I really, really want it to be spring. And I just want to break out the spring clothes and you know, show my legs and things like that. So this is a spring poem. Flirtation. I like my tights electric blue, my shoes of patent leather. This dance I dance is meant for you. I move quick as new weather. My shoes of patent leather shine brighter than my skin. I move quick as new weather to shed the dress I'm in. Shining brighter than my skin, my eyes, they say it all. I'll shed the dress I'm in, let summer fabric fall. My eyes, they see it all, they see what's false, what's true. Let summer fabric fall. I know what we can do. I know what's false, what's true. I dance the dance that's meant for you. Show me what you can do. You like my tights, electric blue. Thanks so much for coming.